originally when I started to put this material together, it was in relationship to the work that Ray and I did, were doing with women's issues and men's issues. But then as the time went on, and I realized how much, when I discovered this book, To Work and to Love by Dorothy Zola, when I was in Portland, and I started to read it, I realized that in this book, she really is dealing with almost all of the things that we've been talking about, including when I got to the end, which is just about the time that she, Judy was planning her course, she talks about her vision and how she visions, work and love in the future. And even the words that she's using are the same kinds of things that we're about. And so almost most of what I'll be sharing today comes out of the reading of this book, and in a sense hoping to draw some kind of conclusions or to draw together some of our struggles and some of the issues that we've been dealing with in Winter Program. She begins her book talking, when she talks about a theology of creation, she's saying we cannot have a theology of creation apart from the theology of liberation. And she points to an essay that was written in 1936 by Gerhard von Rad, who is a German biblical historian. I guess that's the place we put him. He's also a theologian, but biblical theology. In which he was arguing in this paper that faith in creation was a comparatively late development and decidedly a secondary belief. The book of Exodus was written prior to Genesis, and that Israel's understanding of God grew out of God's delivering them out of Egypt. Zola says that it is in light of the Hebrews being freed from oppression by a foreign military superpower that we have to approach the conceptualization of creation in the biblical narratives of Genesis 1 and 2. We cannot approach the subject of our being without first understanding that we are created for freedom and that our life project is to become free. And it's on this kind of premise that she begins her book. She says, we need to achieve a synthesis of creation and liberation traditions that does not devalue the liberation tradition, but rather apprehends the creation tradition from a liberation perspective. And then she says, let's look at the creation myth and see what is liberating about it and what is oppressive about it. And that which is liberating, she says, is that there is no domination of human being over human being, either prescribed or implied in the Old Testament creation myth. There's nothing there that says anyone has anything over the other. And that which is oppressive, however, to her is that there is a total otherness or separate and distinct character of God. That the earth is sort of a matter-of-fact, godless creation. That God did it to the earth. And that human loneliness is presumed to be the essence of the human condition, apart from God. God is the holy other, and we are the object of the holy other. She says the goal of creation theology is to empower us to say yes, but that traditional theology does not allow us to do that. There's no natural way to affirm creation, but there is a need, even in those who suffer extreme deprivation and hardship, to affirm creation. We need to affirm our createdness, but it is so difficult to do that based on the way we've been taught to understand the creation myth of Genesis 1 and 2. She said that the God of creation that is portrayed as Lord and Maker at the cost of our being is the subject of traditional creation theology. We have God as the subject of creation, humanity as the object, we are made from dust. We need to ask, is it true that the Bible makes this claim, or is it that our tradition has decided to select this from the Bible? So the question is not that the Bible does, you know, it's not what it says, but it's how we've interpreted it that perhaps wasn't necessarily the only way to interpret what Genesis 1 and 2 have been saying all along. And she asks the questions, is there not another way of construing creation and the relationship between God and the world? We need to reconceive the divine-human relationship, the doctrine of creation out of nothingness, and the notion of the absolute autocratic freedom of the Creator. She talks then about the autocratic or the orthodox concept of God as Lord, which comes out of the, as also the Greek word kyrios, which is a cultural kind of understanding. I mean, we come out of a cultural understanding of the word Lord anyway. She says it's a, you know, the coercive feudal ruler. And she said such an understanding of God as Lord in that way continues or lends itself to sustaining forms of oppression and exploitation. The other source of when I was doing some of this has to do with Letty Russell's book on the future of partnership, in which she also looks at the use of the word Lord and sees it as having been used primarily because they would not use Yahweh. Because the Hebrew understanding of Yahweh was such that when you named God, then you were profaning the word. So they would use other words for God, other descriptions for God, and Lord was one of them. And that she's the one that says the culture determines the use of the word Lord. And what that meant in the culture of that time, and still I think in some ways continues to mean for us, is that Lord is a male, and usually it's the stronger male who represents God, is the dominant person, the one who has authority, not simply over women, but also over weaker men, over nations, and over the earth. Yahweh, on the other hand, is neither male nor female. But the dilemma, Russell says, for us is that for us to use Yahweh is then to not have a great deal of respect for our Jewish sisters and brothers and their tradition. So we're caught sort of in a bind in terms of the word Lord. But then she goes on to say that we could look at the word Lord as a way of seeing God as beyond human manipulation. And that Jesus is the example. Jesus, we say, is Lord. But Jesus' way of demonstrating what it means to be Lord was to be a servant. And so he is the servant Lord. And he's not two different personalities. You know, and so it's that whole sense of what does it mean to be a Lord? It means to serve. It doesn't mean to have control. It doesn't mean to force other people to obey you, to do what you say. It means to be, to enter into their life and to serve them, to live for them. Both Zola and Russell deal with the whole concept of dualism. And the hierarchical model in both would say that is not what was intended in the creation myth at all. And this is where I get to what I wrote on the board. This is what Zola would do. She says that we are created in the image of God and we therefore are able to imitate God. And that, she says, can be very scary. She doesn't say that, I say that. Could almost be considered heretical. To think of ourselves as being able to imitate God does not come out of our tradition. We cannot be like God. We cannot be God. And so what we've done is we've created God as the other. There's an infinite distance between God and humanity and the earth. God is the holy other. God is a stranger. God is Father. God is a form of requiring our obedience, which leads us to understand salvation. She used the word forensic justification, that simply that God does it. And that sin, then, in with God as the holy other, we understand sin as that which is idolatry or disobedience, the things we do that are wrong. If we can turn to God, to being like God, there's some kind of a union there. There's a relationship there that God created out of a need for relatedness. That God is within us. God is not apart from us, but God is within. It is as if we give birth to God within, that God is birthed within us. That with God in us, we are empowered to be in relationship to each other and to God. And salvation is to be caught up in union with God. And this is the part, I found this really interesting, her concept of sin. Sin is alienation. Sin is emptiness. Sin is that deadness that Dan talked about. What was his name again? When he went back to Holland and the people were dead. It was as if they had just, you know, there wasn't this connectedness again. So that's the traditional, this would be perhaps a new way of looking at how we relate to God. She uses Carter Hayward definition of God as power in relation, which is to define God not as a noun, but God as a verb. Power in relationship. It is a power in relation that depends on humanity for making good. Power in relation that depends on humanity for making justice, for making love, for making God incarnate in the world. And to do this is to undo evil. The doing of good and the undoing of evil is the human act. It is a human responsibility. God is our power to do it. And if we see ourselves related in relationship to God, as opposed to being done to us by God, then we have a sense of what it means to have power. I've asked Karen to read Isaiah 58, 6-12.
Is not this what I require of you as a fast? To loose the fetters of injustice, to untie the knots of the yoke, to snap every yoke and set free those who have been crushed? Is it not sharing your food with the hungry, taking the homeless poor into your house, clothing the naked when you meet them, and never evading a duty to your kinsfolk? Then shall your light break forth like the dawn, and soon you will grow healthy like a wound newly healed. Your own righteousness shall be your vanguard, and the glory of the Lord your rear guard. Then, if you call, the Lord will answer. If you cry to him, he will say, "Here I am." If you cease to pervert justice, to point the accusing finger and lay false charges, if you feed the hungry from your own plenty and satisfy the needs of the wretched, then your light will rise like dawn out of darkness, and your dusk be like noonday. The Lord will be your guide continually, and will satisfy your needs in the shimmering heat. He will give you strength of limb. You will be like a well-watered garden, like a spring whose waters never fail. The ancient ruins will be restored by your own kindred, and you will build once more on ancestral foundations. You shall be called rebuilder of broken walls, restorer of houses in ruins.
She takes this passage, thanks, and uses it as a way of helping us to understand how, in doing justice and breaking every yoke, we become co-creators with God. There's a real emphasis on the fact that we are participants in creation, and that we become co-creators when we undo evil, and that this is an ongoing process. The creation was never completed in the sense that as we are created or to be liberated, to be free, where that's a constant ongoing kind of thing. But I really got excited about understanding how when we do justice and we break the yoke, we not only in a sense are liberating others, but we're liberating ourselves. And that the freedom to be is more connected to relationship than it is to who I am specifically, that personal salvation as opposed to the corporate salvation. The relationship of God to humanity is characterized by mutuality of friendship and empowerment. We are in a mutual relationship with God. It does sound a little heretical or a little different, doesn't it? I mean, is it hard for us to understand ourselves as being mutually, you know, connected to God? God depends on us as we depend on God.
I think, as you're saying that the heresy lies in saying that we are God and we don't need God.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, this doesn't sound like a false teaching in terms of saying that we need one another in relationship. It's when I set myself apart and say, I don't need God, I am God. I don't need you, I am God over you. That's the sin, and that's the heresy.
But there is a sense that we have, at least from my training, it's really hard for me sometimes to read this. I get excited about it, but at the same time, I get nervous thinking about that mutuality. You know, that sense of connectedness, you know, in a way that God is up there and I'm down here. I mean, it's really taking a new look at where God is. And experiencing that. One of the other things she says is that we're not mere vessels into which grace is poured. We are living parts of active love. We are not mere vessels into which grace is poured. We are living parts of active love.
And the thing that helps me on that is her friendship model. And that mutuality means that God needs us as much as we need God. And that's very common.
And see, I would get you too, you know, raised with this whole thing about God doesn't need me. I've said that. You know, God doesn't need me. I need God. Yeah. And all of a sudden I'm struggling with this, God does need me. But what that says to me is that I have to be more responsible too. And take charge, take more power, receive more power.
I think that's also threatening to our traditional view, because we say that God is all powerful and God does everything.
Mm-hmm.
And for me to say that God needs me is to suggest somehow that he's not all powerful.
Yeah.
And that's totally against everything I've ever been taught. That's totally different.
Would you have to kind of expand on the word need?
Need?
Need, yeah.
How would you do that?
Maybe. Well, I guess I still sense that, in the sense that God doesn't need me. I mean, he may need, perhaps, manatee, or he may use manatee to bring about his kingdom, but essentially, if I was not to be in body anymore tomorrow, that things wouldn't collapse.
Oh, well, yeah, okay. What you're saying is that that God's need for you is not as great as your need for God? Is that?
Yeah.
And that God will always be, even though you may not?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So I don't know in terms of that, you know, that need. God can use me for his purpose. Form me, transform me.
Mm-hmm. But can we get away from the word God using me? Can I get to a point, can you get to a point, you know, or any of us get to the point where, well, we're not just the vessels, we're not just the tools.
Object.
Yeah. That we're not, you know, God is not doing it to us, but together we're doing it.
Yeah, because if I use the word use, it's like I'm a puppet on the string. Sometimes I wish I were that God could just pull the strings and I did everything he wanted me to do. But then we get in the whole realm of free will.
Yeah.
And indeed we do have free will to
well,
decide
saying,
to...
Yeah, I'm not saying that I don't want to be used like a puppet at all.
No, what I'm pointing out is that I'm responsible and I have the free will to say whether I'm going to work in relationship, whether I'm going to be God's hands and voice and heart and ear on this earth. And that God doesn't just use me.
Well, I think God needs me to bring about his kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Not just you.
No, not just.
With everybody.
You, not you alone, but each of us. It's sort of like, it doesn't all depend on me. I'm not going to live my life as if everything, I mean, that I am going to be responsible for everything that happens. But on the other hand, I'm not going to live my life as if I have nothing to say or do with what goes on. But I share that with you. I'm in relationship to you. That was God's intention. Is that
it's just one reason we need. I can understand that God needs me, but I can also understand that God doesn't need me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What's helpful to me about that, David, is that would you say that if you died tomorrow, things would go on. But this is true about any relationship. Jenny and I were friends. We had mutuality, you know, in a sense. But she died. You know, I'm still here, and I'm surviving, I'm going on. But that doesn't mean that I didn't need her, and that I don't miss her. And if you died, my contention is that God will miss you.
Yes.
In the evolving and development of his kingdom. That you will be important to God. That you are not in that at the moment. That's the kind of need that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. I'm just trying to narrow down the clarification of the word, the meaning of the word need.
She uses the color purple at the end of the chapter on created in God's image, and she says, this is the part of what you remember we were talking about, God love everything you do, even some of the things you don't, or and the messy stuff you don't. Shug's exceptional reflections on the relationship between God and humans climax in a passionate affirmation of the source of all life. But more than anything else, God love admiration. I think it pisses God off if you walk by the color purple in a field somewhere and don't notice it. God is not synonymous with omnipotent control. Rather, God's power lies in sharing life with others. The admiration that God loves is our sense of connectedness with the whole creation. God, we all have difficulties with praising the God of creation. We all often walk by the color purple in a field and don't notice it. But God does not give up trying to lure us into the oneness of all creation. It's kind of a sense that, you know, God is constantly pulling at us to get us in, to involve us, to make us a part of, to be a power in relationship. Even though we ignore it and walk by it and don't see it, God does not give up in trying to get us back. Wanted to talk a little bit about how she understands sin. And in doing that, I decided that rather than try to capsulize it, I would turn to this section. She says, interpreting the Genesis narrative as an etiological explanation for original sin, a term that does not appear in the story of the fall, seems to be an all-too-orthodox reading of a myth that speaks about our development as responsible human beings who have to make choices between good and evil instead of living in a dreaming consciousness, in the words of Kierkegaard. And one of the things that I thought Zola did a little bit better in the whole fall redemption thing than Matthew Fox was to really, I think she really gets at it in a new way that he sort of tried to ignore it, like it, you know, we could just discount it. And she's not telling us to discount it, but she gives us a new way of kind of looking at it. She talks about when a child learns to say no to her parents or other authorities, it is a sign of the humanness of this little person. She has chosen to be free by saying no. This is the only path by which she may truly be able at a later point to say yes. There is no yes without a no. And I, when I read that, the couple times that I read it, I kept thinking about Claire. You know, that one of the things that I just dread, you know, having known her as a four-year-old, is dread the thought of what is going to happen to her as she grows up. As she leaves here, where it was okay for her to say no, and to have people respond to that no in unique ways, where somebody's going to try to take that away from her. But one of the things that she always said no to, I mean, she would often say no to when she was very tired, was all the parenting that she got from everybody else when all she really wanted were her own two parents.
But they weren't always available.
They weren't always available, but you know, there was a point at which one night, you know, she would always say this, and she, not just to me, but to others, "You're not my mom. I don't have to do what you say," kind of thing. But in a way, that was her saying, "I can't handle all of this control in my life." But she needs to know how to say, you know, she needs to be allowed to say no, so that as she grows up, she'll learn to say yes. And she connects this then to the talk about the disobedience of Adam and Eve, as if they could have remained obedient just by refraining from eating the forbidden fruit of the tree of knowledge. We ought to cease understanding this confrontation with the authority of the Father. This cutting of the umbilical cord is sin. The story of the fall is in many ways the story of a rise in human development rather than the story of our fall into guilt and sin. The myth mirrors the guilt all of us experience in growing up, making our own choices, leaving the commanding father who wants to keep his trees for himself along with the womb of our mother, symbolized by the nourishing waters of paradise and our symbiotic life within it. But there is no way to become an adult while remaining in a dreaming consciousness and in symbiotic attachment to the womb. So in a sense, the story talks about what it means to grow up and what it means to, she says there's no way to mature without breaking away from the parent, without causing pain to the one who remains behind and without guilt. There's no painless or guilt-free path to adulthood, and this is what the biblical story of the fall tells us. The moral option we face is not a choice between obedience and disobedience. There is only one moral choice: to disobey, to eat of the tree of knowledge, and thereafter to live through the hardships of life. Now, I read that and I felt free. I felt like, oh yeah, that, you know, it makes some sense. How does it sound to you?
I have to do that all the catechism.
rewrite the catechism. Okay. Well, she does do some stuff with that on the Ten Commandments. Find out.
So she almost starts like a fall up.
Well, there's more on that, but I just, you know, just that statement.
Up to responsibility.
Mm-hmm. She says, it's really a moral choice to contradict the authoritative voice of the parent God, to take the guilt on oneself and leaving a parent behind and to embark on a new path. By affirming their right to choose, Adam and Eve became adults, at which point work and sexuality, though given with creation, take on a different and more complex meaning. Adam and Eve are now confronted with the consequences of being workers and lovers. And because they have changed through their courageous step, God, the relational being, also changes. God moves from parenthood to companionship. The biblical myth attests to change in God's behavior. God does not condemn Adam and Eve to death, nor does God completely abandon them. In spite of their failure to obey the commanding voice of the parental God, God supports them and makes clothing for them. God surpasses God, the demanding father, and it is this changed God who accompanies Adam and Eve as they exit from paradise. Having risked losing Eden's keeper, they come in touch with a new God. We are called to choose freedom over a childlike obedience, to choose the intricacies and difficulties of work and sexual life over childhood plays, playful simulations of both, to choose conflict over harmony, and to journey out into the world despite our intense longing to remain home and to forfeit our adulthood. If we affirm our adulthood and think about ourselves, not just Adam and Eve, as having eaten of the forbidden fruit, then we may come to appropriate both our sexuality and our work life not simply as a curse, but in their full, often conflicting dimensions. A curse on work and sexuality hovers over our remembrance of a garden of good love and good work. We have to deal with both traditions. It does not help us to pronounce the world inside the orchard obedient and the hostile world of the wilderness disobedient. We have to be able to live within both. She said, all too often Christianity has offered us an understanding of reality shaped by the curse on the one hand and the promise of escape on the other, the ever elusive dream of quitting, going home, and never growing up.
Can I say something
yes.
about birds?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, on the farm we put up some swallow houses that they came back to, as well as other places, year after year after year. We always had the same swallows. Of course, they died off, but then their children came back. There comes a time in a swallow's life when they get pretty big, and the parents try to lure them out of the nest, mm-hmm. and they will feed them once, they never go back on their nest, these little green ones. Once they get out on a wire or on a tree, the parents will feed them for 3 days, and then they're on their own. Meanwhile, they're feeding them. Everybody, every family, it helps every other family in learning to fly. And here they go, swooping around. And some of them, of course, are lost because they get down on the ground and then they can't fly up high enough. The cat gets them, some other thing. But that's the way with God. He says, okay. You're born. Now you have to taste all of life. I'll go with you. I'll help you. I'll help you get started. I'm always there. Because swallows go in families. Mm-hmm. And they all disappear. One day you get up and there's not a swallow around.
Part of what I hear in that, Linda, is I think an affirmation of what Sola is saying. But
yes.
Also, there's a point at which Adam and Eve in the myth said, I'm going to whether you want me to or not. I think that's the difference. You know, the parent God shoves you out of the nest, and they said, we're going to leave whether you shove us or not.
But they waited to be shoved.
No, they chose.
They chose
to be shoved. They knew,
no,
I mean, the consequences of their choosing.
That. Yeah.
Was to get in touch with who they were as a part of God's creation.
There's lots of things that really get turned around with that interpretation, where from a feminist viewpoint, where it was always poor because the woman was being blamed for having caused the sin of downfall. Here, a woman could be praised because she was a courageous one. Actually,
yeah.
Adam wasn't courageous.
That's right. She took the first risk. And some feminist writers have pointed that out. You know, Phyllis Trible does that by pointing out that Eve really took she was the one that made the decision to do that. She took the risk. She wanted to see. She was the curious one. She was the one that had a real sense of what life was or is, could be. She wanted to find out. She was willing, you know. And unless we sometimes take a risk and move out of the space we're in, it's that whole action reflection thing again, you know, of liberation theology. We act, we do, and we have to reflect back on what we've done, and sometimes we'll discover it wasn't probably the right thing to do. But sometimes it is. But it's sort of like saying, I've got some power, I've got some authority. God's given that to me. Something that cannot be taken away from me.
Hope to have a backup to that.
With, as in God?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She connects a lot of this to work as well as, you know, as to love, to work and to love. And the two being really a part of why we were created in the first place. She talks about work is an expression of our being created in God's image. And that work is, and she sees the biblical understanding of work as always being sort of attached to the vineyard. And there are a whole lot of vineyard imageries, and she does deal with that. I could take maybe 2 days to really do, it would be like a book study more than trying to get at what I think we're trying to work out. In terms of understanding this co-createdness, this co-relatedness, you know, to God, gives us a way of looking at how we deal with power and authority and structures and systems. And that's where I was using Letty Russell's book, The Future of Partnership, in which she talks about static hierarchies and dynamic hierarchies. The static hierarchy is usually seeing, you know, the person in charge sees other people as objects to be used to manipulate. In a dynamic and ongoing kind of thing, if we understand the creation is ongoing and life is ongoing and changes and God changes, therefore hierarchies also, I mean, we don't need the hierarchy in terms of a way of getting things done. That there's a power shift according to the goal or objective. I was thinking about this working with Ray, and I did share that once about the process, you know, and we had two people, both of whom had all these things coming out of our experience. He wanted to deal with men's issues, something to deal with women's issues. And how I experienced, at least, not at all, but I experienced a real shift in power back, depending on what it was we intended to get done. It was it felt okay to me. It felt mutual in terms of that power shift. I'm speaking on my experience. But there's a give and take in conflict. There is, first of all, recognizing that there's always conflict. Conflict is a part of being in relationship. In a static hierarchy, conflict cannot be creative. You can't, you know, it's just, conflict is suppressed, in a sense, or ignored by the dominant one until it just explodes. That, I think, is what has happened in Central America. That's what's happening in South Africa. I mean, it's that sense of the people as objects. There is no conflict. They like it this way. In a dynamic and an interchange that maybe the base Christian communities are getting at that, is that whole sense of give and take, a continuing self-redefinition and change. We constantly have to keep looking at what is our goal, what is our objective, and how are we going to get at that. Power can be seen, according to Russell, as the possibility of having of self-affirmation together with the affirmation of others. I can't, you know, it's not just to affirm who I am and what I, you know, my strength or my witness, but also to affirm that others also have that. She talks about a thing, a process of, calculated inefficiency, which simply means that, I mean, to use an example would be, when I work with a group of people, and I know that something's going, you know, we want to get something done, and I know it could get done if I did it my way, because I've had the experience, you know, I've done it this way before, and all this kind of stuff. But I'm working with people who've never had any sense of power in their life. And I then say, okay, even though I know that if I take charge, and I know, it's, you know, and I take charge and I say, you do this and you do this and you do this, it will get done and it will be good. That is just continually enforcing that model. If we're in a point of saying that we want mutuality in our relationships, I have to say to myself, no, you're not, you can't do that. And so things take a lot longer to get done. It's that consensus model, again, too. It's based on a sort of a dynamic understanding of power in relationship. Because it just takes so much longer. But everybody has an investment in it. Everybody's ideas are valued. Everybody's questions get answered. And so, depending on the goal or objective, whoever, the person who basically directs it may be different every day. That was one of my questions of the base Christian community was, is there a strong, you know, one person who's in charge, or does it shift depending on what it is that they're about? And how does it shift? How does that happen? Have they a model that we might learn from?
Rosemary Ruther says, the principles of the Christian community are founded upon a role transformation between men and women, rulers and rulers. The ministry of the church is not to be modeled in hierarchies of lordship, but on a word, and she uses the word diakonia, which means to serve. And the people that have that model most have learned that the best are women and servants. Women can be freed from exclusive identification with the servant role and called to join the circles of disciples or people members, because everybody then is in the servant role. That's the eventual goal, is that we all become a servant. And we share in our servant role. Well, When Zola gets to the section on sexuality, she talks about relationships as being central to human life, and all things are fundamentally social, and it is because of the centrality of our relationships that she rejects a God who is autonomous, remote, and neither desires or needs the other, because we are created together, or to be working together. As our needs for meaningful work, self-respect, dignity, and non-competitive social relationships have been overtaken by consumerism, so have the family and our sexual relationships. And she sees a real connection between the whole consumer society that in which we live and the breakdown of our relationships. And advertising is a big part of it. And I think we were sort of talking about that this morning in terms of how we deal with being oppressed. You know, we don't experience the oppression of those who are really poor, but we really don't have a lot of power control in our lives. But we are lured or sedated and brought into this just by advertising. You can do this if you, you know, you can look like this, you can be like this if you just buy this. And, she said there's no freedom in relating, there's no freedom in a class society in relationships. Advertising fosters the destruction of genuine human values, the respect for the elderly, willingness to help the poor, and the tolerance of disability. It takes away all our desire to be in community. And part of the structure for the male-female thing is that the men have always been the producers and the women now have become the consumers. In the conventional nuclear family, man is the producer and woman is the consumer. The woman therefore becomes the special target and victim of this new type of mass education. She was sold before, now she becomes the buyer and adapts herself to the cycle of prostitution. Once the mere object, now she is the agent of the transformation of community. For where your treasury is, there will your heart be also. And advertising dictates where the treasures are. So we've really been caught up in some real model. She says the language of dream, wish, and hope plays an important role in our lives, but people in advertisements do not have needs other than materialistic and individualistic needs. This is particularly dangerous for minorities or underprivileged groups such as women and the poor. One of the things that Dan talked about was that people ask some of the questions that they ask people. You know, what's our life like? You know, there is sort of that sense of we want a part of that. And she's saying that they're being beat by the advertising. I mean, if I said to them, you wouldn't want my life. They look at me and think, they might think I was crazy. Because it does, the advertising tells them it's great.
Does it say let us find out for
ourselves? Yeah, let us find out for ourselves, yeah. One more thing, I think. The commandments. That was another exciting thing for me. She says, even students of theology sometimes distrust churchly language. I remember a classroom discussion when I tried to share with seminarians my emergent vision of love relationships. There it hit me that for many people, vision often connotes normative rules or divine commandments. There is a distinction, however, between a commandment and a vision. The Ten Commandments can be understood as the ethical proscriptions of a deity who admonishes us that we shall not commit certain acts. But it is also possible to read the Ten Commandments in a future-oriented sense, thou wilt not do this or that, almost as a prophecy that has a much more inviting, non-threatening character. A vision of love and sexual relatedness does not partake of threat or intimidation. With regard to human sexuality, there is no ethics that would endure or enforce specific conduct because sexual ethics arises out of an agreement between three partners. Even the more subtle forms of coercion or discrimination have no basis in a theological reflection on sexuality. In this sense, good theology is marked by liberality and tolerance. But on the other hand, she says, you know, that there's the conservative way of looking at sexuality and or sex, and then there's the liberal, but she has a radical one. So she does not go with the, you know, anything goes. That is not what she's saying. But what she's saying is that it isn't, it comes out of our desire to, or out of our vision for what the world can be, is how we end up in our relationship with other human beings. We can no longer see each other as objects. For me to see another person to satisfy my needs. Nor do I necessarily need to be involved in a relationship to satisfy the other person's needs. But because we have a relationship, because we are people who are no longer who are strengthened by our love, we are then empowered and enabled to go out and work together to make a difference. So she kind of comes to that point of saying that we really, there was a part of this that was a struggle for me because essentially she's saying that it's better to be in a relationship than not. In terms of that means for me, and what that in turn as it has meant for me, allows me or empowers me to be more free to explore changing the rest of the world.
Any specific kind of relationship, or
yeah,
the idea of relationship? It seems like the right side implies relationship all the time.
Sexuality is a sacrament, a sign of grace in bodily illness. But I don't know where exactly it is that would give a specific example of how she touched that. But I found it a little hard to.
Where is it, Rob?
For me?
Yeah.
Well, I guess there was a sense of she's not saying it's not okay to be single, but she's saying that she would hope that people would continue to search for not, and she doesn't use the word single either, because she's not dealing with heterosexual relationships, she's dealing with relationships. She does very specifically talk about the damage that being sex as a procreative kind of thing has done to people within the homosexual community. So that it isn't that, it's just that to be in a committed relationship is better than not to. Yeah, yeah. She is married. She has a child. She's one of the child's children. But I can't explain it.
Is it possible that a single person, or married people, one can be in committed relationships with other people, I can have committed relationships with friends and so on.
Yeah. All right. Says, genuine erotic love opens the hearts and minds of lovers to other people. The statement may sound banal, but I'm afraid that the Christian adherence to a sharp distinction between Eros and Agape has succeeded in blinding us to this reality of love. To love more is to know more, not only of our partners, but also of the human community. There is no Eros without Agape, and I would hasten to add, no Agape without Eros. Only a superficial perspective would limit relatedness to the exchange between sexual partners. the trivial myth of the idyllic island where you and I find refuge from a hostile world represents a dangerous form of sexual escapism that betrays our greater need to be united with the world in which we live. Yet this is one of the most enduring and influential cultural myths celebrated in film, advertising, and other mass media. The myth speaks to us because all of us are sometimes precisely in need of a remote and shining hideaway. And however diverse our dreams about island life may be, they have one thing in common. They are motivated by the suspicion that our real life is elsewhere, not here, but far away. But I wish I could find that one. Perfect. Probably by tomorrow. She really connects to the whole concept of nuclear destruction. And her reason for writing this book came out of two decisions. One had to do with Central America, and one had to do with the building of MS missile. And to really start to look at how we are really in a position of destroying the creation of which we are a part. She says, when we close our eyes to the cries of the helpless, we kill not only the agape in us, but the eros as well. Likewise, we cannot confine love's ecstasy to the private realm without detracting from our public life. The depth of our loving relatedness is decisive for our public life. The fact that first world peoples devote the majority of their natural, intellectual, and financial resources to preparation for war and death is not unrelated to our psychosexual reality. The growth in atomic weaponry tells us something about our capacity for love. If we publicly worship death, how strong then is the personal option for life affirmed in our sexual relationships? What can be said of our emotional vigor if it does not break into politics? In lovemaking, we accept our creativeness, we recreate and embody ourselves. But if our embodiment in lovemaking does not move us beyond the acute, narrow joys and sorrows of our own bodies to the body politic, then it does not confine us. Earlier I criticized what is called casual sex because it does not enable us to grow into wholeness. In a way, however, all our sex is casual because our lovemaking has not led us to make justice in the world. It has not led us to transform the erotic power into revolutionary power. Our intimate personal relationships each reach fruition when they connect us to the struggles and sufferings of other people. Transcendence in sexuality leads to solidarity, and the absence of solidarity with others is a sign of the absence of sexual relations. Solidarity intensifies our ecstasy, strengthens our trust, and is essential to our home. I guess my intention was to try to give us at least a different sense of understanding. Not necessarily that we have to buy into. I get really excited about this. It really did say some things to me about how I might want to look differently and how I see myself in a relationship.
But I sure want to raise the question that Niebuhr put dead wrong about that comment.
He probably wasn't either.
Or what about
Bart? Carl Bart.
Because, you know, that's again, the leader told you this, that would be okay to speak. I'm much more comfortable personally out of my experience with the conflict that this and the other point of thought brings. The fact that it isn't the way it was is for me to find a change. Rather than saying, you know, if it's changing something that I used to think, then the faith isn't there anymore. To me, it's quite the opposite. And I'm terribly worried when that isn't happening in my life, that my faith patterns aren't being challenged. So for me, it's more the nature of faith to do that in and out of saying, well, I'm listening to Sully today, I'll listen to Tribble tomorrow or somebody else the next day. For me, it's more about part of the dynamic, you know, the conflict, inner conflict too, is the give and take, is the mark for me.
I wouldn't really disagree with that either. Mm-hmm. It's just that you're thinking, how can you how can you find the truth?
Yeah.
You know, and that's part of that ongoing conflict. But you back to somebody brought this up long ago about those who don't have the, and sometimes the opportunity, or who aren't led in ways, you know, that only the theologian can find it, sort of thing. And just thinking how do you find it, or how do you?
I would sort of share with you what you said to me in regard to the worship of last week. That it was a new experience in some ways for you to hear and experience the lay participation. You know, why wasn't it like this when I was a kid and had to sit through a Good Friday service? I mean, it comes out of your experience. I think we change out of our experience. Was it you? Well, both of you said that. You were together. I mean, you don't always look alike. But both of you did share that with me. You know, that whole sense of, yeah, I remember too, of the pastor being up there, and, you know, that whole hierarchy. That we experience it. It comes out of our experience. It isn't necessarily, you know, my experience. I think I relate to Zoe's work at this point because of what I experienced. Because what she says, she affirms what I already knew, or what I already believe. And said some things that I didn't believe, but I was working on.
And that's where I guess I think sometimes then we get in the danger of thinking the old, what may have fit someone else's experience more than the new, but sometimes we kind of run roughshod over that then and forget that out of all different experiences, different things are going to fit.
Mm-hmm.
And where we can't just hold to the old because it's old, neither can we just latch on to the new because it's new. And it's all that, so many things.
Was this at all helpful in terms of drawing? I was hoping to be able to draw together a lot of the things into one sort of understanding of a theological understanding of what initially started out in terms of theological understanding of what Ray and I were trying to do, but as I thought in terms of what has been going on through all of Winter Covenant, or did it just create another conflict?
Both.
Yeah.
That
is,
really
okay.
Did you talk about that, expand on the concept part, on the status part of it?
On the status?
Yeah.
Well, trying to think of it in terms of, okay, the person who's the boss, you know, like in the steel industry, and I think about all those people that I worked with in Sudan who were simply objects. I mean, they were like puppets to the officials in Philadelphia over there. That the conflict any kind of conflict that might have come out of their frustration and not knowing whether they're going to work next week or not would not be heard at all by the head of the USDA. He didn't care. I mean, or maybe he does, but it obviously doesn't filter down. There's no dialogue between the worker and the president. And because there's no dialogue, because there's no sense of being able to share that conflict, it doesn't mean that there isn't any. It just means that it's buried, and that eventually it just kind of erupts. We operated as a nation working with Central America for hundreds of years, believing that those people, really liked, needed us there. They liked what we were doing for them. They, you know, it's that kind of sense of, hey, they're willing to work for nothing. It doesn't cost them very much to live there anyway. But inside of those, you know, in terms of their lives, I mean, they didn't even, at first they didn't know how or weren't even aware that they could respond. And then when they started to respond and to ask questions and to say, hey, we don't like this, we're saying, you can't disagree with us.